You are now online with Andrea, with your host, Andrea Garrison.
Good afternoon. Welcome. You are now online with Andrea. I am your host, Andrea Garrison. I'd like to encourage all of our listeners to practice the universal law of giving by doing whatever you can to reach out to help others. Our topic today is The Globalization of Love, the book by author Wendy Williams, originally from Canada, now living in Austria, who now has a TED Talk on the globalization of love. Welcome back, Wendy. How are you?
Very well, thank you. It's lovely to be back with you, Andrea. Thanks for having me again.
We met some years back, and I love your topic. I love your book, The Heart with Wings. That is so special, you know.
Love flies, doesn't it?
Right. And it seems, since we last spoken, it really does fly. The topic is flying, right? Hopefully your book has been flying off the shelves. Because it's a beautiful, book. And certainly, the whole concept of the globalization of love is a beautiful one indeed. If you would please share a little bit about your journey, as well as, a brief summary of your book, The Globalization of Love. We did a really comprehensive interview on your book, so I want to encourage people to go back and listen to that program, which is archived. But for those who are not aware of your wonderful work and your beautiful story, if you could just share a little bit with us, that would be great.
Okay. Well, the globalization of love, as the name implies, it's about multicultural relationships and romance and marriage, and how couples from different cultures, how they navigate their path through life. And in the book, I look at all kinds of issues from language, religion, food, celebrating the holidays, children, even death in some cases, and how culture impacts all of these elements that we share together in life, and how what the dynamic is between a multicultural couple where all of these things are a little bit different depending on their cultural constellation and how they mix up together. And the book is based on interviews. I spoke with about 150 people in total and basically created the chapters based on these different themes. So you can read the book almost in modular format as well. You know, some people, young lovers might skip the children section and look at the chapter on marriage, for example. And other couples who are at a later stage in life, they might skip the chapter on how international couples meet and talk about family issues and going into retirement and so on.
Yeah, beautiful. A question just popped into my mind as you were speaking. And two questions, actually. One is love blind? And then another thing, is love different for younger couples versus older couples?
Two huge questions.
I know, don't you love me? And they just popped in my head. I didn't plan that. Are you ready, Wendy?
At least I'm sitting down for this. Well, to address the first question, is love blind? I don't think it is. I think that love, of course, does cast a bit of a veil over our vision and can sway us in one direction or the other. And sometimes it allows us to not see things that we don't want to see, and sometimes to see things that aren't actually there. But overall, I wouldn't say that love is blind, because I think that there is within every individual, you know, there's sort of the heart and the head, and there's sometimes good communication going on between these two body parts, and sometimes not as good. But I don't think love leads to total blindness.
Okay. And
as for your second question, I mean, it's, of course, you know, young love is, it's probably a lot more fun, isn't it, than mature love? but I think that there's a difference when young couples meet and they have their entire lives ahead of them. They have their relationship ahead of them, as opposed to couples who have been together for several years or several decades, who have so many common shared memories, experiences, and have shared so much in life together. And I think that creates the basis for a different type of love. And I mean, psychologists, of course, would talk about, you know, sort of infatuation and probably more sexualized love at the beginning of a relationship, and how it becomes more comfortable, but also more trusting as a relationship develops through the years. But yeah. I think with multicultural couples, of course, they also have more to learn at the beginning of a relationship, because often they go, when they first meet and they're from different cultures, sometimes they don't necessarily recognize that they're from different cultures. You know, sometimes they feel like they're soulmates, and it's only later in the relationship that they start figuring out that their cultural basis really does have an impact on their romantic relationship and their marriage and their family.
Yeah. And what do you have to say about unconditional love?
Oh, you just shoot at me.
Well, and I want you to know, this is just popping into my head as you are speaking. You're inspiring me, Wendy.
What have I done to myself?
There's something about, you know, the topic. It's just flowing. Believe me, I have prepared questions, and none of these are on the list. Don't you love spontaneity?
Okay, yeah. Now I'm a bit nervous to see what's on that list, actually. But to get back to your question, I don't know. It's you know, love is it's a funny thing, and it's something that it changes all the time, doesn't it? And you know, some days you're together because you're madly in love and infatuated, and some days you're together because you're together. And I think that's just part of how the dynamic of a relationship changes over time. And it's important for people, you know, to kind of accept that not every day, you know, to quote the Smurfs, not every day is going to be like cupcakes and rainbows. And to be able to flow with that a bit more easily, and not to have these very high expectations. And of course, that happens a lot today. There's you know, a lot written and said about the romanticization of love in Hollywood movies, for example, and that it sets up very unrealistic expectations for what happens in daily life in a relationship. And that's, I think, that's something that people really need to learn to accept. And within a multicultural relationship, of course, there's probably even more give and take, more understanding. There's the learning period is probably a lot longer and more complex than it would be in a monocultural relationship.
Well, when a couple gets into a multicultural relationship, do you think they see the differences at first, or do they see more the similarities? They see that, you know, I'm really connecting with this person. Doesn't it go beyond the fact that there are so many differences? I mean, initially, even for them to connect.
I agree. That there's often this feeling of soulmates, and they focus very much on the similarities between the two of them, and the synergy that develops between the two people in the relationship. And that's why it sometimes it takes more time for them to figure out that part of the personality, what they believe to be the personality of somebody, is actually part of their cultural sort of background, and it's a characteristic that may be very common in throughout the country or the culture that their partner comes from. You know, whether it's, let's say, if somebody really likes somebody who talks a lot and is very effusive and a lot of fun and speaks with their hands and always has something to say and maybe, you know, yelling a little bit and very, very expressive with their emotions. That contrasts very much, very strongly with somebody, for example, from the Nordic countries in Europe, where they're not openly expressive with their emotions. They don't speak with their hands. They speak in a very controlled way. And they consider yelling or raising one's voice to be a lack of control and very undignified. And so at the beginning of a relationship, you know, if we've got a combination of this sort of high expressive and low expressive cultures, one may think, oh, you know, wow, she's so energetic. She has so much life within her. But then when he goes to meet her family or her country, he sees, wow, they're all like that over there. You know,
right.
It's without wanting to stereotype. And the same way, when it's a low expressive culture, you know, somebody may think, oh, I really like him or her because, you know, she's so methodical in what she says, or she thinks before she speaks, and really appreciate that. And, you know, they're a very good listener, for example. And then, you know, they fly over to the country where their partner is from and find out, oh, wow, you know, most people over here are like that. And so that's kind of a fun thing, but it's interesting to see where does personality come from and how much of it comes from the individual and how much of it comes, you know, has a cultural background to it. And I don't think there are any clear lines that we can draw, but it is a fun path for couples to go on. Sometimes it can be very frustrating, of course, before they learn to understand, to recognize these cultural influences on their partner's character.
Now, that's interesting. I'm thinking now the cultures could be different, but the values could be the same, right?
And, absolutely.
And the values is what really makes a relationship work, correct?
Yes, I agree. Yes, definitely. Definitely. And you see that a lot in multicultural couples where the countries and the cultures and the languages and sometimes even the religion is very, very different. However, as you say, the values, strong family values, for example, or taking care of the elderly, or the respect with how people interact with one another. Often these are very common things. So you may have two people where on the surface it sounds like, you know, north, south, black, white, you know, high affiliation, low affiliation kind of thing. But then when you really look at it, you see that their cultural value system has a lot in common. And that, of course, creates the basis for a very strong relationship then.
Yeah. I mean, because there are people that say when you go beneath, say, the skin, you know, inside, we're all the same, pretty much.
Mm-hmm. We are.
We are the same. So how do you balance the heart and the mind, since you brought that up? It's all your fault.
You're almost becoming nasty.
I love you, though. I love your work. I think it's just amazing. And, you know, but how do you balance that? I mean, regardless of the culture, you know, how do you balance the heart and the mind? That's a challenge for any couple, right?
It absolutely it is, and I think that the answer applies to any couple as well as multicultural couples, and that is the journey that a couple go on together throughout life. Is it really is about lifelong learning and changing. And, you know, I think it was Barbara Bush or some president's wife who said, you can never be married. No one has been married really married for 20 years to the same person, because after 20 years, you're not the same person. And I think that applies really to any relationship. And so what it requires is that the partners are always learning about each other and seeing how their partner is changing to also reflect and look at themselves and say, well, how am I changing as well compared to, you know, the slim young blonde that I once was, you know? and how am I today? No, I'm just joking about that. But you know, people really change their interests to a certain extent. Their values may even change over time. And so how does any couple deal with that, with the changing interest and focus of themselves and of their partners? And in a multicultural relationship, what is very interesting is that the influence of culture actually changes over time. So at the beginning of a relationship, for example, let's say a couple meet when they're at university, they're on some, you know, international university exchange program, and then they really have a lot in common and they fall, you know, madly, deeply in love, and don't really consider culture to be much of a variable within their relationship. And then a few years later, maybe they decide to get married. And then culture starts to play more of a role, because it's like, okay, well, how will we marry? Where will we marry? Which religion will we marry in? Which language will we marry in? And, you know, who will give away the bride? And which color will the dress be? And so on, and things like that. So culture starts to creep its way into the relationship. And then children come along, and that's when things become very exciting, I must say.
Yeah.
You know, something simple like naming the children and agreeing on a name and even how you pronounce the name and how many names and, of course, the religion of the child.
Right.
And so this is where early in the relationship, an individual might think, well, you know, I'm fine with my, you know, we're not that religious. But only then when a child comes, then suddenly they start to think, well, what kind of values do I want my child to have? What kind of traditions will we practice together? And that's where the culture really, as they say, it creeps into the relationship and may start to have more of an impact than it did earlier. So this is combined with, you know, how people change over time as well. So their personalities, their interests are changing, but also their cultural values or the attachment to their cultural values is also fluctuating over time.
Yeah.
And that, you know, can lead to a lot of excitement within a multicultural relationship.
Yeah, great. So since the last time we spoke, which was a couple of years ago, you've done a TED Talk. So for those who are not familiar with a TED Talk, if you can just explain, what is a TED Talk and why were you invited to give a TED Talk?
Okay, well, a TED Talk is basically the opportunity to speak for 18 uninterrupted minutes without props or slides to an audience of usually about 400 in the crowd. And it's all very kind of, the stage is well lit, of course, and the speaker stands on a circular red carpet and does not leave the carpet. So there's no pacing back and forth, you know, as Steve Jobs did when he gave his presentations.
You have to stand there, right?
Yes, and talk about your area of expertise or your area of interest, and really communicate it in an engaging way, and also in a way that everybody can sort of access it and understand it and enjoy it. And this is filmed, of course. In my case, I think there were 5 cameras focused on the stage where I was standing. And this is filmed and then uploaded to TEDTalks.com or the various affiliations. So there are cities all over the world who are able to host TED Talks, and they're usually called TEDx and then the name of the city. So in my case, it was TEDx Vienna. And so my videos has been uploaded there. And Yeah, that was it was a fantastic opportunity. I was invited to this particular TED Talk because what the organizers usually do is they have a theme that they're going with. And so they invite speakers who have a knowledge base that is related to that theme. And in the case of the TED Talk that I did, the theme for that evening was the future of intimacy. And so they talked a lot about how couples are relating to each other. And well, you can go online and find out more about it. But there are, of course, now with technology, there are improved or different ways for couples to communicate with one another, even though they're not in the same geographic location. And I brought in a talk about how couples are just changing because of the globalization of love, quite literally, and what is that meaning for international or intercultural families.
Yeah. So how did you prepare for the TED Talk, and how long did it take you to prepare? And then tell us about what it was like for you to go on that TED stage. Were you nervous? You know, but I have to tell you, Wendy, you were ready years ago, because I think we talked for about 2 hours about the globalization of love. And I think that we had some time constraints, or we could have talked for another four. So how do you take that topic and, you know,
and condense it into 18 to 20 minutes? It was really challenging. It was, because, of course, you know, every chapter in my book, I'm passionate about. And for me, every chapter is equally as important as the next. So, but it's always the case when you're given an opportunity like this, it's important to be able to bring it down into, you know, two or three main points that the audience can relate to and understand, and what they can take away. Because, of course, if you give them too much information, you know, people just get lost in it. What I did is really, I told two different stories, and one was about food and how, you know, food has so much cultural context to it. You know, it's what we eat, how we eat, when we eat, who prepares what we eat, and who we eat it with. You know, all of these things are really affected by culture. And so I talked about a story that it was quite funny. It took place in the United States and between an American and somebody from Africa, and how one of them was offered leftovers at a meal and felt very insulted by this because it was not common in their culture to be offered leftovers as food. You know, they thought, no, the leftovers, that's, we feed leftover food to farm animals. We don't serve it to our honored guests. And how this almost broke up the relationship. And it was only later on that the person recognized that in America, leftovers are actually really, you know, valuable, and people love leftovers, and there are cookbooks about leftovers. And that there was no offense, there was no insult intended by offering this guest leftovers, that actually the family embraced him and were very happy to welcome him into the family. But he wasn't feeling that because of this unintended, you know, sort of insult of being offered leftovers. So that was the one story I told. And then the other story is a personal experience that I had had that happened after I'd written the book. And that was kind of fun too. Well, fun. It's a bit an odd choice of words, because I actually talked about the funeral of my father, so in Canada, and then the funeral of my father-in-law, which was just a few months later here in Austria. And what it was like, just the different practices with, you know, within this setting of being in a funeral, and how our multicultural daughter was dealing with it. And, you know, so I talk about, I mean, it sounds very gruesome, doesn't it? Because I talk about open casket funerals versus closed casket funerals. And how did this look from the eyes of my daughter, who was 4 and 5 years old at the time? And, you know, where do the grandpas go? And And, you know, and ultimately, of course, she asked, well, when they get there, which language will they speak? You know?
Oh, and, that's so interesting.
So as fun and as funny as you can make a story about funerals, particularly, you know, my father and my father-in-law, that's the story that I told. And ultimately what I concluded in the book and what I concluded on the TED Talk stage as well, is that we are all sort of ambassadors for world peace, you know, because we're multicultural couples are proving, you know, how people can get along. And it doesn't matter, you know, what culture you're from, what religion you are, what skin color you are. We're all the same. You said it earlier. Underneath, we're all the same. And we all want the same things in life, ultimately. And so that was my sort of grandiose conclusion. And it was a very nice experience. Because, of course, it's so different from writing a book. And, of course, people who write books usually write because, you know, we like to sit alone in the room by ourselves with our computer and our cat or whatever it is and create something. And that's very different from getting on a stage in front of 400 people under bright, shiny lights and tell our story, the story that we'd written. And, you know, usually authors are better writers than they are speakers. And so it was a challenge for me.
Oh, no, that's not true in your case. I think you're wonderful and engaging. We had a great time chatting, just like we're doing right now.
Thank you so much. That's really sweet of you.
It's no, true.
But it, what was nice is the feedback, because, of course, when you write a book, before you start getting feedback, a lot of things happen. You know, the book goes into print or it goes into digital format and it's sent out there. And the feedback comes actually months after you've performed, so to speak. Whereas on the TED Talk stage, the feedback comes immediately thereafter, you know, and because, of course, the speakers are in the audience and during the break, you know, a lot of people came up and talked to me and said, wow, you know, how do you know my story? You were talking about me up there. How did you know? And so that was really fun for me. And it reconfirmed my belief that, you know, I wrote the book for a reason. And it confirmed that it's a book that it had to be written. And I'm very glad that I wrote it. And I'm very proud of it, too.
And you should be. So how did the TED Talk change things for you?
Well, of course, once you've done something, like if you're not accustomed to going into an arrangement like that, speaking, public speaking in front of a lot of people, because, you know, they say that apparently like the second scariest thing in life, like after death, for most people is actually public speaking. And so
that's it. So, that's funny.
And so, I don't know if it's, you know, statistically proven, but one of the other speakers told us that at the TED Talk. Yeah. And I understand why. But it was of course it was a fantastic experience, because that's really, you know, that's kind of looking at your demons like straight in the eye fearlessly. And it was funny because I had a very important meeting just 2 or 3 days after that, and where it was one of those kind of classic situations where I was meeting with a group of men. I was the only woman in the room. It was in German, which is not my native language. And I think that because of I was charged up, you know, with the TED Talk energy. And so I went into this meeting absolutely fearless. You know, there was I thought, if I can deal with a TED audience, you know, then this, you know, this is 10 men. This is a piece of cake. So that, I think that that has been really nice just for my, you know, my personal self-confidence and readiness to be a public speaker again. So that was really good. And of course I get positive feedback because I see, sometimes I get messages on my website or on Facebook, and people say, hey, I saw your TED Talk and, you know, it was so great. And thank you for sharing the stories. And that's the nicest part. And that's, it started with the publication of the book, and it continues to this day, that and was enhanced by the TED Talk, where for so many people to say, thank you for writing this book, because now I know I'm not alone. You know, I know what I'm going through is not unique, that there's a whole community of multicultural couples who are having the same experiences and going through their marital life together. And so that's very rewarding. You know, it gives me quite a nice feeling.
Yeah, it's beautiful. It really is a beautiful work. So if you would please, because you do mention this in your book, GLOLO, can you explain to our listeners what this term means? GLOLO.
Yeah.
I love that.
Yeah, well, it started while I was writing the book. You know, the title is, I wouldn't say it's a long tongue twister, but The Globalization of Love, you know, too many syllables. And it's kind of started while I was writing it. I just needed an acronym. I needed something that was shorter than The Globalization of Love, particularly when I was typing. And, oh, that dates me, doesn't it, to say I was typing on the computer. But basically, I couldn't always write The Globalization of Love or Multicultural Couple or International Couple or Inter-Ethnic Couple. And so I wanted something sort of short and quick. And somehow GLOLO just popped up one day. I think I might even credit my husband with that, because one day, usually I would write until about 6 or 7 o'clock. And then one time he came into my office and he said, is it time for a GLOLO teeny? And that was the beginning. So we created the drink, the GLOLO teeny.
Oh, that's
and
great.
And that was always the indication that it was the end of the working day. You know, it's GLOLO teeny time.
Right. So what is the most important issue right now, would you say, in a multicultural relationship? Today versus, say, when you wrote the book?
Mm-hmm. My answer to that question is always the same, because there is never one most important issue. It always depends on the couple and their particular personalities and their cultural makeup. But it also depends very much on the geography of and the countries where the couples are living. And, you know, I was thinking about this just, you know, in the past couple of weeks with this travel restrictions that you're facing in the United States, and how I thought, well, what on earth can that be like to, you know, when your partner is from a country that is on a list that is, you know, sometimes banned from entering the country where you live together. And how can, you know, or if it's not your partner, if it's just, you know, they're visiting family, or, you know, maybe a baby is being born and the family is coming over to share in that experience, and how some families then are being denied that they cannot be with their families in the way they want to be at important, you know, times in life. And so that's the thing with, you know, which that makes it the most, you know, the passport country at that particular time is the most important issue in the GLOLO relationship. However, that wouldn't be the same, for example, in Europe, where there is no travel ban. Passport country is not the issue. Then it's something different. And so, as I said, it's really, it depends on the couple. It depends on their particular cultural mix or cultural constellation. It depends on the time or the phase of life that they're in. As I mentioned earlier, whether they're younger or experiencing childbirth, naming children, taking care of aging parents, you know, whatever it may be, these are different phases where the most important cultural variable changes. And all of this is based on geography. So it's kind of a vague answer. I apologize for that.
Well, that's fine.
That's
yeah.
A true answer, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a true answer, and it is variable. What advice do you have for multicultural and GLOLO couples? Do you have just some general advice that you give?
Yes. I mean, so it's so obvious, Andrea. It's read my book, The Globalization of Love.
I second that.
So that's my first piece of advice. Now, of course, what I always say is to learn as much about each other's cultures as possible. And sometimes that's easy to think of. For example, when two people, when they have a different passport country, they know that they're different. And so they're more aware of the differences. But sometimes, for example, in the United States, in Canada, where you have a lot of, we've had a lot of immigration over the years. So maybe you're second or third generation in your own culture and aren't even aware of how that family culture affects you. And, you know, even East Coast, West Coast, and how this can sort of influence a relationship. So I always say that couples should learn as much as possible about each other's culture, religion, language. I know that's a tough one, but learn the language, or at least the basics of the language, because the mother language influences so much the way we communicate. And if you don't know how your partner communicates in their mother tongue, then you may misinterpret what they're saying in the language that is not their mother tongue.
Right.
So get to know all of these things. So that's the first thing. And the second thing is to expect changes. And what we've already been talking about, over the course of time, over the years and even the decades together, the cultural influence changes and the cultural dynamic between the two people changes. And couples need to learn to go with the flow and expect. Sometimes it's more about my country, my culture, my language, my religion, and sometimes it's more about yours, and which is the basis for any relationship. And my third piece of advice is always approach it with humor, because there are going to be issues and situations that are very challenging. And, you know, I had this with my husband recently when we were even at, you know, preparing for a funeral in Canada, and just our different attitudes, our different expectations about what a funeral is, we're different, even though, you know, you think Austria and Canada, you know, what can really, you know, go wrong there? And it just led to so much humor, really. And we had to laugh about these things, even under the sad circumstances, because we recognize that we've also been together long enough that we know sometimes when we're talking to each other that we're talking about different things. and we just have to laugh our way through it. And I think that's my third and final piece of advice for Glolo couples.
So would you say that's one of the secrets to maintaining a successful, you know, long-term multicultural or Glolo relationship? The humor is, would you say?
It is, because there's so many areas for misunderstanding in a multicultural relationship, and the language, for example, is one, and that's a really important one. You know, how do people express themselves, and when do they say things that it comes out in a different way than what was intended? And that can happen, you know, even if we're all speaking English together, can't it? And
right.
But with where we have two people where either one or both are not even speaking their native language, you know, that can really lead to some very interesting situations and conversations that where they're not even meeting each other in terms of understanding what's going on. And often they need to just have more patience too and say, okay, what are, you know, it's also one of the practices in good communication. Repeat what the person has said in your own words, in the way that you understood it, and say, is that what you are wanting to tell me?
Right.
And just to, you know, to double check.
And
you know,
yeah, double checking, that's a good thing. And, you know, I was thinking, when you look at a dictionary today versus a dictionary, say, even 20 years ago, I mean, words have taken, well, there are new words that weren't in there. And then other words have taken on additional meaning. Mm-hmm. So it is so important to kind of like repeat and am I understanding you correctly? You know what I mean? Is this what you're saying to me? It is important to do that because even in the same language, the meanings can be different, which is interesting, isn't it?
It's interesting and yeah, sometimes difficult and if the couples are ready, can hopefully they can see the humor in it. And that really diffuses, you know, misunderstandings and so on. And that really helps when the couples feel like both parties are really trying to understand each other, you know, that leads to a bond of mutual appreciation, you know, and that leads to, it's a good basis for a long-term relationship.
Yeah, that's beautiful. So tell me, Wendy, how do you define true love? I knew you were gonna laugh.
It's Valentine's Day, so everybody's talking about love, and I guess I think my definition of true love maybe it's more of an example of true love. Okay, so I've been married to my husband for 18 years now, and we have a daughter. She's almost 8. And this evening we decided, let's go out for pizza. Okay, it's the one meal where all 3 people are happy with dinner. And we went out to a pizzeria. My daughter was grumpy. So basically she asked for my phone so she could watch Netflix. And sorry, that was a blatant Netflix promotion, not intended.
Netflix is happy. It's that glow, low, love, Netflix.
And, you know, we had the restaurant, of course, was overcrowded because it's Valentine's Day and the service was slow. The pizza was cold.
But everyone was happy.
And my husband and I, you know, we just looked at each other you know, we were kind of laughing about the situation and he said, you know, don't worry, the magic is still there. And I thought that's what true love is, where, you know, despite the less than romantic, less than ideal circumstances, you could really, you know, rather than being, I don't know, upset about an evening that didn't go that well, we can just laugh about it and say, you know, that it's no problem. We still, we know, even if Valentine's Day is a total flop,
the love is still there. Boy, that was a terrible Valentine's Day, but I love you anyway. deep down. That's beautiful.
And that's what true love is, isn't it? It's just accepting the person and the circumstances and not always having expectations about how things are going to be.
And I guess, you know, the humor is a big thing. And you and I, we've been laughing throughout the whole conversation. But to be able to laugh together, I guess, and see the humor in everything, because that certainly eases the stress, doesn't it? And makes it easier to communicate when you can laugh together.
Yes, yes. And I think it's a barometer for a healthy relationship. That's being able to laugh about things together.
That's beautiful. So do you have anything to share that we have not covered? Any closing reflections? And of course, you want to give your website as well.
Well, yes, my website is globalizationoflove.com. And the book, The Globalization of Love, is available, you know, online on Amazon and most other online sellers. There's the print version and the digital version as well. And I don't know, I guess my final message tonight is, actually, I think that the globalization of love, the concept of it, never mind the book, I think it's more important today than it ever was. And because there seems to be a bit of a contradiction going on in society, you know, that because the rate, the number of multicultural and international marriages continues to increase. And but yet politically, the world seems to be separating a little bit, you know, disintegrating, and which I find very worrying. And yet still we're all just people, and ultimately we all just want the same things in life. And I think it's important to promote this globalization of love and to tell the politicians and the policymakers around the world that we are ambassadors for world peace, and that's what we want. We don't want walls, you know, we want the globalization of love.
Yeah, what a beautiful message from a beautiful person.
Thank you, Andrea. Thank you.
Thank you so much. And hopefully you'll keep me posted and return again. So we
I
can,
will.
Can, because it's a timeless topic. As mm-hmm. you say, it's actually growing, which is a good thing. The globalization
yes.
of love is glowing. I mean, mm-hmm. and growing, glowing and growing. And it does have wings, doesn't it? It's just you know, your book now, I think, even has more meaning, the graphic, more yes. meaning now than it did before to me for some reason.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I don't know why that is. And I don't know if you feel the same way, but there's something very powerful about
yeah.
the graphic, the heart with wings.
Yes, yes.
Yeah. Well, thank you.
Thank you very much. It was lovely to be here. It was a lot of fun with you, as always.
It's always fun. And thank you so much for writing your book, for doing the TED Talk, and continuing the mission to spread the globalization of love.
Thank you, Andrea. I appreciate it.
Okay, take care.
Bye. Thank you.
Bye-bye. I would like to thank our guest, Wendy Williams, for being here to discuss her TED Talk and her book, The Globalization of Love. For more information, visit www.globalizationoflove.com. I would like to encourage all of our listeners to practice the universal law of giving by doing whatever you can to reach out to help others. To each and every one of you out there, thank you so much for joining me, Andrea Garrison, and connecting here online with Andrea. Listen to me live or listen to the archive. Just continue connecting heart to heart. But in the meantime, do whatever you can to reach out to help others and never underestimate the power of a friendly smile. Take care.
Thank you for connecting to Online with Andrea with your host, Andrea Garrison.